It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about the two facilities that house migrant detainees here in Wisconsin. First, it's time for a weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement from the U.S. Supreme Court today. Reaction is coming into Harley-Davidson's decision to move production overseas in response to tariffs, and a far-reaching immigration bill failed to pass the House today despite support from President Trump. You can weigh in on our question of the week at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the announcement from Justice Kennedy that he is retiring? What do you think the timing of his retirement says about who he wants to see take his place? What do you want to see from the president in an appointment, from the Senate, from Republicans, from Democrats? What are your hopes and fears here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter with The Guardian based in Washington, D.C. Sabrina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Sabrina, we had a bunch of top stories from today, and this retirement announcement immediately jumped to the top of the list. Can you talk about the impact of this retirement?
Well, this is going to mark a tremendous shift in the Supreme Court. Now, the court already, of course, has a conservative majority after Neil Gorsuch was confirmed. That was, of course, President Trump's first pick after Republicans had blocked Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland in the 2016 election. But even though the court has leaned conservative, Kennedy, of course, has been one of the pivotal swing votes on the bench on issues that have included, for example, a landmark decision to legalize same-sex marriage. I think that because if you look at Neil Gorsuch, the nomination that Trump made last year, it's unlikely that he would be choosing a more consensus pick. And he has said his pick will be from a short list of reliably conservative justices or judges, I should say. So the question now is the fight in the Senate and whether or not Republicans can confirm the president's next nominee.
Now, the rules have changed some on this sort of thing. Do the Democrats have really much sway on this one?
Well, the rules have certainly changed, and now Republicans can confirm a Supreme Court nominee with a simple majority. Their majority is even more narrow than it was when Gorsuch was confirmed. They have just a one-seat majority. Of course, Mike Pence can act as tiebreaker, but it certainly means they have very little leeway, Republicans, that is, to lose any of their own members. They could only really lose just one senator. I think the question is to what extent perhaps Senate Democrats, given they don't have a lot of power to actually block a potential Supreme Court nominee, is do they find other issues where they put up roadblocks? Do they try and block other nominations or other issues from moving forward until and unless, one, Senator McConnell delays the vote for his Supreme Court until after the election, which he has, the midterm election, which he said he's unlikely to do, or perhaps as a bargaining chip for the president to put forward someone who is more of a centrist figure?
People are, Democrats in particular, pointing toward a tweet from Senator McConnell back in February 2016 after the death of Justice Scalia, quoting, "The American people should have a voice in the selection of their next Supreme Court justice," kind of the opening round of his effort to hold off on Merrick Garland's nomination, successful effort, until after the election. This is closer to Election Day. That's not likely, I think, these comments from Democrats, not likely to sway Senator McConnell, though.
Absolutely not. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made clear that the Supreme Court will be a top priority and that he expects Republicans will move forward with a nomination as quickly as possible. Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he said he hopes that there will be a hearing within weeks. I think they know that there is very little time before the midterm elections. When you look at the calendar and how much more they have to deal with, they want to certainly proceed as quickly as possible. Of course, there's going to be the obvious question around why was a presidential election year different than a midterm election year? That's the distinction that Republicans are making, is that a midterm election year is not the same as a president who would have the power to appoint Supreme Court justices. I think the counter hearing from Democrats is, one, Republicans set this precedent in 2016, and the line they're putting forward is if the if if we should wait for the American people to be heard in terms of which president or which party gets to choose a Supreme Court justice, we should also wait for their voice to be heard in terms of which party has the power to confirm the next justice. It won't have a lot of sway. I think a lot of it will be about galvanizing voters at the polls, though.
We got a caller on the Kennedy retirement announcement at 800-642-1234. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. I am actually worried about the Kennedy retirement, and I say that because I look at Gorsuch, who was Trump's appointee lately, and I feel that this was, if you look at this week alone, with the Janus case, an overturning of precedent in a way that would hurt workers, specifically by hurting unions, not in their ability to do politics, but in their ability to actually make sure there's good safety conditions and things like that in the workplace. And on top of that, I believe Gorsuch was one of the people that not just wanted to punt on the gerrymandering case where we've got rigged elections here in Wisconsin, but to actually get rid of the case, which means he doesn't care about what I think are some of our most important and basic rights.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. Justice Kennedy had voted with a conservative majority on a lot of the big cases this year, but looking over the last bunch of years, I see he's departed from that group double-digit times versus only once or twice for a lot of the other conservatives. So this is, Sabrina, a difference maker.
Absolutely, and I think that in some ways, this was foreshadowed in yesterday's significant ruling on the president's travel ban on several Muslim-majority countries, where it seemed as though perhaps retirement was on Justice Kennedy's mind. He sided in that case with the majority and with the other conservative justices in giving deference to the president's authority on the travel ban, but he wrote a rare opinion, part of a piece of an opinion where he essentially criticized some of the more derogatory statements that the president had made about Muslims and people of a certain faith without, of course, naming the president. And some wondered if he was in some ways trying to have it both ways, thinking about his legacy, thinking about when he has been able to stand on the side of equal rights and civil rights, and wondering if perhaps that decision, which was one of his final major decisions, might be viewed differently when you look at the overall impact of his legacy. But certainly, if we go back to just the short list that the president put out, a lot of judges who were confirmed to the federal court on a party line basis. So I think you very much would expect to see another Neil Gorsuch, not a consensus pick like Merrick Garland under Obama.
Talking to Sabrina Siddiqui about some of the top stories in national politics. You can still join in at 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts on Justice Kennedy's retirement announcement. Again, 800-642-1234. For now, though, Sabrina, let's move on to a couple other issues. Harley-Davidson, this is a story with an impact in Wisconsin. They announced this week because of tariffs from the European Union that were a response to President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs, they're going to be moving some production overseas. We've heard a lot from the president on this, especially on Twitter and in person. What kind of things has he been saying?
Well, the president is arguing that Harley-Davidson is trying to use his tariff policy as an excuse, when, in fact, they had already announced plans, according to the president, to move production, some production at least, to Asia. Now, Harley-Davidson, of course, has said that the president's tariffs, which he announced on European steel and aluminum imports, that was part of their decision-making process. I think this is some of the backlash now manifesting itself in actual practice with respect to the president's unexpected tariffs announcement, which at first he suggested he might turn back on, but has since decided to proceed with, despite opposition from Republicans in Congress, as well as the business community, which of course constitutes a great deal of the Republican constituency. The irony, of course, is that a lot of the impact of the tariffs will affect those who voted for Trump, manufacturing communities in middle America, agriculture and farmers. So where this fight appears to be going is whether or not Republicans on Capitol Hill are going to take some kind of action to overturn the president's tariff policy, or at least to limit his authority on tariffs. And we just don't have an answer yet on that. Some Republicans threatening to do so. They haven't done it just yet.
Here's a listen to House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin reacting to all this.
I'll say it again. I've said it always. I don't think tariffs are the right way to go. I think tariffs are basically taxes. And what ends up happening is you get escalating tariffs or escalating taxes. One of the reasons we did tax reform is to make it easier for businesses to keep manufacturing in America and exporting overseas. Because with taxes like tariffs, some companies make overseas in order to penetrate foreign markets. That's why we want to lower those barriers.
So that's the House Speaker, a Republican there. But any sign of legislation actually moving forward on this, Sabrina?
Well, there have been some discussions around tariff legislation, and namely it would be to limit the president's authority on the tariffs that he can execute, which at the moment the president has a great deal of power, of course, to enforce new tariffs. Mitch McConnell, notably on Wednesday, did signal that they might take up tariff legislation. He said there's a lot of concern within the Republican conference. It's something that I believe Orrin Hatch, who is the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, is working on. You've had Senator Jeff Flake suggest that he would hold up the president's judicial nominees if there was not a change in the tariff policy. Today he's facing a question as to whether that also applies to the Supreme Court nominee, to bring things full circle. But I think you're starting to hear more and more Republicans speak out. Perhaps it would be something that is voted on as part of the Farm Bill, which is an ongoing debate at this moment. Of course, anything that Republicans do send to the president's desk would have to get his signature. And so the question would be also whether or not they would be able to secure a veto-proof majority.
We're talking to Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter at The Guardian, looking at some of the top news in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Our question this week about the news earlier today, Justice Anthony Kennedy says he's retiring from the U.S. Supreme Court. What's your reaction? What sort of replacement are you hoping for or worried about? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation with Sabrina Siddiqui from The Guardian, looking at some of the top national political news this week. Let's take another caller on our question about Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement, asking for your reaction. Cindy is with us in the Fox Cities area. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Since I heard the announcement, I literally am just distraught. I'm physically sick to my stomach. I think Kennedy retiring is the nail in the coffin of democracy, and that we will have a dictator running this country within the next couple of years. It's just totally scary.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Sabrina, I don't know, Democrats reacting maybe not quite as negatively as Cindy, but not far off, I would say. Is that fair?
Certainly. I think that they feel there are a number of issues that could be at stake, and one happens to be access to abortion. I think that it's unlikely, despite political rhetoric, perhaps that Roe v. Wade would be overturned in its entirety. It would be difficult on a national level, I think, for the Supreme Court to render abortion entirely illegal. But there's a great deal of concern if you look at some of the 20-week abortion bans, some of them less than that, 12-week abortion bans that have come up at the state level, that perhaps something like that could pass muster in a more conservative-leaning Supreme Court. Of course, health care, the Supreme Court has on two occasions upheld critical provisions of Obamacare, of Barack Obama's health care law, the Affordable Care Act. Might that change if it is challenged in another lawsuit? There is, of course, LGBT rights. This term the Supreme Court sided with a baker who did not side with a baker, but effectively punted and did not rule entirely on whether or not a baker should have to provide service to a same-sex couple. So these are just some of the issues that I think Democrats are pointing to, that progressives are pointing to. The question really is, because Republicans have so successfully used the Supreme Court as a rallying cry for their base, can Democrats turn that on its face and make this a major rallying cry, both in the midterm elections in November, as well as looking beyond to 2020.
I want to move on to a couple other issues out there. I know the Supreme Court crowded out a lot of other things, but a couple immigration-related stories, Sabrina. Another immigration bill came to a house, came to a vote in the U.S. House, the Republican-controlled House. It was being called a compromise bill among Republicans. What ended up happening today?
Well, the outcome was not unexpected, that Republicans had failed to pass an overhaul of the immigration system, but it was a far more staggering loss than I think initially anticipated. The president actually tweeted his support for the bill, so it was also striking that you had more than 100 Republicans, 112 to be exact, who did not heed the president's call and support the bill. This was a compromise, though, only among Republicans, designed to bring together the moderate and the conservative members of the GOP conference. And it would have effectively provided temporary status for Dreamers, the young undocumented immigrants who were brought here illegally as children, who, of course, lost their protections last fall when the president rescinded DACA, the Obama-era policy that gave them temporary protections. It would have also provided funding for the border wall, the one the president has called for along the U.S.-Mexico border. It would have limited legal immigration. It would have ended the visa lottery program. So there were a lot of conservative priorities tucked within this. It would have also barred child separation at the border, but essentially allowed families to be detained together indefinitely. So it was never going to have support from Democrats, but it was striking that such a large number of Republicans also broke with the party and did not support the bill. I don't think you would see any immigration bill passing before midterms. It remains just as contentious an issue as it was in 2013, the last time it was debated in any significant way.
And some Republicans seemed a little nonplussed that the president supported it this morning, but not that long ago had tweeted that House Republicans are wasting their time chasing the immigration issue right now.
Well, this has been sort of emblematic of President Trump and his relationship with Republicans in Congress, where he is not at all involved in negotiating the policy details, despite, of course, his vow to be a great deal maker. He is on more than one occasion. This happened also with the efforts by Republicans to repeal and replace Obamacare. He has threatened to veto legislation that Republicans have been negotiating for weeks, if not months. And really, in part, it's because he doesn't want to give away or what he perceives as any concessions with respect to his own agenda. And so it's not clear what he wanted from a compromise immigration bill at this particular stage. The White House never really specified, nor did they put out their own framework. And so I think Republican leaders on Capitol Hill have been very much hamstrung by a West Wing that isn't providing much clarity on what the president would actually sign, and that gives very little incentive then for Republican lawmakers to take these votes, especially in an election year when there could well be a political price.
And also on immigration, this back and forth at the border now, the administration's self-described zero tolerance policy of prosecuting people resulting in family separation. What's going on right now?
Well, there are a couple of issues that are coinciding. And so one issue is that the administration, of course, said it would no longer separate children from their parents at the border. But it said the zero tolerance policy would very much remain in place, which in effect is the administration saying anyone who crosses the border illegally will be charged with a crime. And in some cases, they're also doing this with those who are presenting themselves at legal ports of entry and seeking asylum. So there is a dramatic shift in just how the administration is treating those who are seeking entry into the country, whether through legal or illegal means. Now, because of that, they then are detaining these families. Now they suggest that they are detaining them together. Of course, the current law stipulates that children cannot be detained for more than a period of 19 days, although some argue that there is some leeway, there is some discretion the administration can use, especially if any of these families were to have a bond hearing, let's say, at day 21 or 22, then is it really worth being arbitrary and separating children at when you hit the 19-day mark? They also have not really indicated what their plan is to reunite the children, the roughly 2,300 children who have already been separated from their parents, to reunite those families. And so there are just a lot of questions that remain unanswered, and it's really not clear if they have even stopped separating some of these families. There have been some indication from activists on the ground that there are very much still families who are being separated and not with a credible justification that those children are in danger, but the administration essentially just using its own discretion.
And Sabrina, before we run out of time, I want to look at a primary result. A handful of states had primary elections yesterday. In most primaries, incumbents in House races are winning. You know, sometimes it's touch and go, but they win. But there was a big upset yesterday in New York. Representative Joe Crowley, one of the top Democrats in the House, lost to a relative political unknown, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Can you talk about this? I think upset is a fair word.
It's a stunning upset, arguably one of the biggest political upsets in the 2018 midterms thus far in the during the course of the primaries. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, just 28 years old, if she is elected in November, she will be the youngest member of Congress. She is young, she is a woman, she is a woman of color. I think she is very much more representative of the district. If you look at the Queens area, also, it's fair to say that Joe Crowley, who is in Democratic leadership in the House, is one of those who was eyeing the national spotlight, rumored to be a potential successor to Nancy Pelosi, and seems to have lost touch with his district, seems to have phoned it in. But even having said that, I think Ocasio-Cortez's politics, they are to the left of the party. She is incredibly progressive on economic issues, embracing Medicare for all. She's also called for the abolition of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, for free college tuition, for a federal jobs guarantee. And essentially what you have is a young Hispanic woman from the Bronx who I think constituents decided was better representative of the district than a white male from Queens. And now I wouldn't necessarily take away too much and say that this applies to all Democrats everywhere. It's also important to remember that New York, especially if you're closer to the city, is already much more progressive than other parts of the country. But it's certainly a warning for the establishment not to take their incumbency for granted.
Sabrina, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian. She was with us for a weekly look at the news in national politics. The immigration debate has largely played out over the last few weeks in Washington, D.C. and along the U.S.-Mexico border. But there are two facilities that house detainees for Immigration and Customs Enforcement here in Wisconsin. In a new piece for wiscontext.org, our next guest took a closer look at those facilities and talked to the local law enforcement officials who help run them. Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, ICE, I understand, doesn't have their own facilities here in Wisconsin, but they have detainees here in the state. Where are they housed?
Well, the two main facilities are the county jails in Kenosha County and in Dodge County in Juneau.
And these are the county jails, basically, right?
Yes. And that's a pretty common arrangement that federal law enforcement has with different jails around the country. And, you know, this kind of network of detention centers also includes private prisons and, you know, some actual federal facilities.
Do we have any sense of how many migrant detainees are in these Wisconsin facilities on any given day?
Yeah, we do. And, you know, there isn't they're not apparently experiencing the, you know, boom that you'd expect given kind of the stepped up enforcement. When I spoke with the Kenosha County Jail, they said, and this was just earlier this month, that they were holding 166 detainees for ICE, and the Dodge County Jail reported having 188.
And does this mean there are ICE staffers, ICE personnel at these sites 24/7? How does that work?
No, there's not really federal staff that directly works out of these facilities. You know, there will be federal inspectors and agents, you know, working there doing stuff at different times, but no federal staff really are based out of these facilities.
So what's kind of the life cycle? How would someone find themselves detained and ending up in one of these Wisconsin county jails?
Well, that's a really interesting thing because there are reports of detainees being transferred all throughout the system, you know, around the country, you know, from one place to another, sometimes on very short notice and sometimes on what seems to be a kind of an arbitrary basis that has to do with like shuffling around capacity. The two jails in Wisconsin are kind of connected to ICE's Chicago field office, which obviously covers a pretty broad swath of the Midwest. So there'll be a lot of detainees from the Midwestern region, but you know, from what we're hearing, it's not just people from within the region. People can get transferred around quite a bit.
What do we know about the conditions facing migrants detained at these facilities?
Well, we do know that there are certain standards that ostensibly the jails are supposed to meet and that they're, you know, inspected and whatnot. But, you know, you do hear obviously concerns from people who've been incarcerated there and who work with detainees about, you know, whether the conditions are being met. There's, you know, complaints about crowding, complaints about food. That's something I haven't really delved into deeply enough in my own reporting, but there's, you know, clearly enough concerns out there that it bears, you know, some further scrutiny.
And how about access to legal representation, especially since, as you said, they might move abruptly from one facility to another?
Right. You know, again, they're supposed to have access to legal representation, but there's a lot of recorded instances of people being moved around and that kind of hindering their ability to, you know, even keep an appointment with a lawyer. You know, if you're being moved from Wisconsin to Indiana or what have you on short notice, that obviously makes it pretty hard to keep in touch with your attorney.
Talking to Scott Gordon from wiscontext.org, talking about his piece on immigration and custom enforcement and a couple of facilities in Wisconsin that work with them to hold migrant detainees here in the state. Scott, you mentioned that this is, you know, contracting in effect with the federal government. And in your piece, you write there's an economy surrounding a county jail's willingness to do this. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah. So, these jails basically get paid, the county governments get paid on a per prisoner per day basis. And for both Kenosha County and Dodge counties, this adds up to, you know, millions of dollars in their annual budget. You know, Kenosha County is anticipating bringing in almost $6 million in this fiscal year for housing federal inmates. And Dodge County is looking at a little over $7 million. And, you know, in some years have reported bringing in as much as $11 million. And the sheriff's officials in both counties are really open about this and kind of have referred to it in terms sometimes of running a business and in terms of economic benefits. And, you know, if you look at, you know, $5 million or $7 million or what have you, that's a big chunk of their budget. And, you know, one sheriff's official in Kenosha County explained to me, you know, this is something that helps the county keeps its tax levy down and so forth. So it really does have, you know, quite a significant financial impact on these local governments. Mm-hmm. And they know it, and they, you know, presumably want to keep it that way.
And you mentioned in your piece, I can't remember which county's officials mentioned that, hey, this has kind of a tourism spillover effect as people come to visit maybe loved ones who are being detained.
Yeah. In 2013, the former Dodge County sheriff spoke on Wisconsin Public Television, and, you know, he said, I think his wording was, it puts a little pulse in the local economy when people coming to visit friends or loved ones who are detained, you know, come to town and spend money at hotels and restaurants, which I'm sure is true, but it's, you know,
something you don't think about usually.
Yeah. It's a bit shocking to hear in this context, mm-hmm. You know.
And you mentioned there hasn't been a boom in migrants being detained at these two facilities. It sounds like it's pretty steady despite what looks like increased enforcement efforts nationwide.
Yeah, I mean, both Kenosha and Dodge counties have been doing this since the early 2000s. You know, ICE was founded in 2003, although their actually direct agreement is with the U.S. Marshals Service. And as it was explained to me, ICE kind of piggybacks on that. But yeah, they've both reported that their numbers of federal immigration detainees have been fairly stable over that time. And, you know, I mean, these are jails that have to balance the federal detainees with, you know, other people they're incarcerating, you know, on a local basis, and only have so much capacity overall. You know, in Kenosha, it's just shy of 1,000 inmates that they can hold at their facilities. And in Dodge County, I believe it's, you know, just short of 500 or so. So, you know, these aren't huge facilities to begin with. And you know, neither one has had really trouble keeping up, apparently, with the amount of detainees that the federal government is sending them.
And on the national level, then, you mentioned there are private, for-profit businesses that might be detaining people elsewhere in the country, not here in Wisconsin. That's picking up the slack, I guess?
Yeah. A report put out in 2017 by the National Immigrant Justice Center surveyed you know, all these detention centers around the country that ICE uses for immigration detainees. And it included some other places in Wisconsin that ICE has used sometimes over the years on a mostly as-needed basis. And their analysis found that 71% of ICE's detention facilities were operated by private prison companies. And, you know, much like these counties, the private prison companies generally will get paid on a per inmate per day basis. And the same analysis found that local governments made up, you know, the other 29%, basically. So this arrangement with, you know, a local sheriff's office holding federal detainees is a fairly common thing.
Is there any talk of more ICE detention capacity in Wisconsin, whether private or maybe another county saying, yes, we want to do this too?
I know that ICE has looked at building more of these facilities in the Midwest, and that there have been proposals from especially private prison companies to get in on that. I'm honestly not sure at this time if they have more capacity planned for Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there. Scott, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org. His latest piece looks at the facilities that house migrant detainees in Wisconsin. You can find a version in English and Spanish at wiscontext.org. When you go into a grocery store produce section, there's usually a lot of visually appealing produce everywhere you look. No oddly tinted broccoli, no extra pokey bits on the carrots or peppers. A lot of produce doesn't meet the standards of the grocery store shelves, and that produce often ends up in landfills, even though it's still tasty and nutritious. As part of an effort to fight food waste, the company Imperfect Produce offers a subscription service where it takes ugly but still edible foods and offers them for home delivery at a discount. And this summer, in a partnership with the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative, residents in the Milwaukee area will have access to them. Riley Brock is content manager for Imperfect Produce. Riley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And Ron Balsamo is sales manager for the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, Riley, tell us the story of ugly foods. Why is this such a problem when it comes to food waste?
Yeah, it's a really big problem, but it's kind of a hidden problem because if you only ever see produce in the grocery store, you'll just see the really flawless stuff, right? But, you know, as you said earlier, grocery stores want to put these really gorgeous displays in front of us, so they'll only select the really spherical, uniform stuff that builds really pretty pyramids. But what you don't see is the stuff that doesn't make it to the store because it's not quite symmetrical. It's got scarring, it's too small, it's too big. And historically, that stuff has been falling through the cracks of our food system, causing billions of pounds of perfectly good produce to go to waste every year. So a couple years ago, our co-founders said, there's no need to waste, you know, delicious, healthy fruits and vegetables. Let's get this stuff from farmers and get it to people that need it. Let's get it to hungry folks so they can cook more at home, so they can eat better, and so we can really help support our farmers as well, because anytime a farmer can't sell something to a store or they have to sell it for break even or even a loss, right, that's a lost economic potential for the farmer. And farming is really hard work. And, you know, we really want to make sure that all that work goes towards feeding people.
And Riley, let's be clear. We're talking about produce that might look weird, the color, the shape, what have you. This is not rotting or bad produce we're talking about.
Correct. Yeah, that's a really good clarification. Yeah, we're not sourcing anything there's nothing wrong with it. It just looks different. And, you know, I think historically this stuff has kind of been marginalized because stores think, oh, people won't buy it. You know, we've really shown, you know, we're in seven cities now across the U.S., including Milwaukee. This past week, we started on deliveries on Monday. And at this point, we've really proven that, you know, folks really want to buy this stuff, and they don't really care how it looks like. It just has to taste good, and, you know, that's really what matters, right? It's flavor and health, not appearances.
And, Ron, let's take this here to Wisconsin. What kind of challenges do farmers face when they grow produce? They know, hey, people could eat this stuff, but nobody wants to buy it necessarily because it looks weird.
Well, you know, that's a really good point. You know, the Food Hub, this is our sixth year in operation. And basically what we wanted to try to do was work with our family farms to make them profitable, to be able to get together with the farmer themselves and figure out what we can do as a group to be able to sustain the family farms here in Wisconsin. Well, here comes Imperfect Produce. Imperfect Produce added another revenue stream to the farmers that they'd never had before. If the product didn't make number one quality or USDA number one quality, usually the farmer had to resort either to leave it in the field or just bury it or just throw it away. Well, what this does, it most certainly opens up another revenue stream for the farmer and helps pay the bills.
And in talking to farmers, Ron, did you hear from them that, like, yeah, you know, most of our stuff would fit the grocery store shelf model, but there's a significant amount that doesn't, and it goes to waste?
Well, yeah. Actually, we had a meeting with Imperfect Produce before we started this year's planting. And by talking, we had a group of farmers meet with Imperfect Produce, and we talked about some of the challenges they already had. We usually come up with a number of 20% of the crops we grow usually don't make USDA number one. So by looking at 20% and adding that to the bottom line, we were able to boost, hopefully, the profitability of all our farms this year. And they are very supportive of this program.
And, Ron, this is new to Milwaukee, but you've been working in other states. Is this usually how you work? You go to farmers or farm groups to try to source this produce that doesn't look shelf-ready?
Well, mostly what we have done in the past is just donated. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you would get Feeding America that would come through and look for some of this product to be able to feed the homeless. Well, we also support that as well. But again, for revenue stream purposes and to be able to get something for the product versus nothing, Imperfect Produce helps us out quite a bit with that.
Yeah, and Riley, talk about your partnership with farmers and farming groups around the country. How does that work?
Yeah, basically our number one mission is helping reduce waste and support farmers. So what that means for us is going out there and finding folks, you know, finding stories like what Ron was just talking about, who they're working hard to make a living, but they have 10, 20, 30% of their crop every year that for whatever reason they can't sell. You know, grocery stores are really fickle in terms of their specifications, and, you know, the store can afford to say, no, yeah, we're not going to take that this year. But for the farmer, that's, you know, their livelihood. So we have a really awesome supply team that's, you know, sourcing from dozens of farms all across the country, and we really try to support the local community everywhere we are. So as we were preparing to launch in Chicago last winter, like, that meant going out and meeting farmers in Ohio, in Michigan, in Illinois, in Wisconsin, and starting to build out these networks, right? You know, produce is a really relationship-based industry, and, you know, we want to build that trust and that understanding both ways. So farmers know they can trust us to help support them and help them feed more people with less waste. And, you know we can trust farmers to bring us really high-quality, awesome stuff that, yeah, it might look a little quirky, but it's still perfectly tasty. But, yeah, we're really proud to be supporting as many farmers as we are because, you know, everyone, when you think of waste, you think of the environmental impact, right? It's a huge, you know, environmental problem, right? We're wasting so much food as a country every year as people are still going hungry, right? So it's an environmental problem and a moral problem, but it's also an economic problem. It shows that our food system is really inefficient if we can't market 10, 20, 30% of what a farmer's growing. So we're trying to solve as many of those problems as we can with our produce boxes, but, you know, we can't do it without the farmers. So, you know, the partnerships are everything.
Talking to Riley Brock, content manager for Imperfect Produce, and Ron Balsamo, sales manager for the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative. They're talking about an effort. It's just come to Milwaukee, trying to take the produce that might look funny, it would look out of place on a store shelf, and instead of putting it in a landfill, ultimately still getting it to consumers. Riley, do people get this stuff for cheaper than they would the pretty stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. We're able to offer a great savings to folks. You know, everything we're selling is cheaper than the store, often to the tune of 30% or so. So it's a good discount. It's a good way to make your grocery dollars stretch further. You know, especially if you're buying organic produce, like that can get pricey pretty quickly. So we're really proud to make this stuff more affordable and more accessible as well. You know, this is a home delivery service. So if you live in a part of town that's a bit far from a market, you can't make it to the store, you know, there's not a farmer's market in your area, you know, for whatever reason, like, we're really trying to make healthy, fresh fruits and vegetables accessible and affordable for everybody. So definitely the cost savings helps with that.
And Ron, do you think this helps people get in touch more with kind of where their food comes from? Because I think anybody who's gardened or farmed knows, hey, not everything that comes out of the ground looks, you know, like it does at the grocery store shelf, but it still tastes good. Is this going to help people maybe connect with the concept of how food is grown?
I actually believe it will. I really do, because if they actually was on a farm for a day, they get a better understanding of some of the product that does come out of the ground. And if they actually had a bite of it, they would understand it tastes the same. The quality of the product doesn't diminish because of the size, and it doesn't diminish because it has a dimple that it's not supposed to have. So the product itself is delicious. The colors, the size doesn't mean a thing.
Riley, does this take some, I don't know, sort of mental retraining for customers to get into? Because I'll admit, sometimes on the store shelf, I'll, you know, pick the melon without the big, you know, blemish in it or whatever, even though I know they probably taste exactly the same. Do we have to kind of recalibrate our expectations here?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Honestly, I would reiterate what you said, though, earlier, which is that anyone that's ever gardened or, say, their grandmother had a lemon tree, they intuitively know what we're doing, and they'll look at our produce and say, that's not imperfect produce, that's just produce. You know, that's just how nature made it. I think it does involve a little bit of expectation shifting for those of us that have only ever seen produce in the store. You know, if you only interact with fruits and vegetables in a grocery store setting, you know, you'd be forgiven for thinking that's what all of it looks like. It'd be like if you grew up in a town where everyone was a supermodel and suddenly you go to a normal town and, you know, there's a wide range of people in different shapes and sizes and you're like, oh, whoa, these people all look weird. But that's really just an expectations issue. And so we're about, you know, kind of gently opening people's eyes to the fact that, no, like, produce comes in all different shapes and sizes and colors. And, yeah, it's really all about the quality and the health benefits, and that appearance is only part of the story. And especially once you're cooking it, I think people intuitively get that, it, you know, you're going to be washing it, chopping it, peeling it, roasting it, frying it, sautéing it. So how it looked at the start really doesn't matter. You know, cooking is all about transformation and making the best out of what's in front of you. And we've found that people are very receptive to this, actually. They get the produce. They love the cost savings. They love that they're helping support farmers. They're getting to eat better and eat healthier. And then they almost forget, like, oh, okay, I guess it looks a little bit different. But, you know, so what?
Just a few moments left. Ron, this is brand new in Wisconsin, the Milwaukee area. What are your hopes for farmers with this imperfect produce plan?
Well, like I said, I believe that most of our farming members, which we now have almost 200 participating farms, they're really enthusiastic about this program. Because, again, these are farmers and families that have been eating this type of produce their whole life. So they like the idea of it being shared out there to the public and making the public aware that this produce is just as good and just as tasty as any other produce.
We'll leave it there. Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure.
And Riley, thanks for taking the time.
Really appreciate it. It's a pleasure.
We've been talking to Ron Balsamo, sales manager of the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative, and Riley Brock, content manager for Imperfect Produce. They join us to talk about their partnership, which means Milwaukee area residents can get delivery of unattractive, maybe beauties in the eye of the beholder when it comes to produce, non-standard looking fruits and vegetables at a discount. If you've got some funny looking produce in your garden, email ideas@wpr.org. Send us a picture. That's Elvis Presley. Okay, you may have figured that part out. That's him singing 50 years ago today at the taping of his famous TV comeback special. There are actually two big Elvis anniversaries in the news this week. Yesterday, the anniversary of his last ever concert, 1977 in Indianapolis. And on this day, in 1968, Elvis and his band started recording this TV special. I think it aired in December of that year, but they kicked off taping. It was going to mark a comeback to live music for the King after 7 years away from the live stage. To mark that anniversary, movie theaters will be screening the original TV special on August 16th, the anniversary of Elvis's death. Are you an Elvis fan yourself? Let us know. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. What got you into Elvis? Do you still listen? Did you ever see him play in person? Love to hear your story. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I saw some of the behind the scenes online of this taping. It was the first taping, definitely shaking off the cobwebs, a lot of stops and starts, but looked like they were having a lot of fun with some very adoring fans. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.